Ladies and gentlemen, I'm always appreciative of that well-remembered and splendid salute. As many of you who are here tonight know, I formed the excellent habit of coming to Chautauqua more than 20 years ago. And it was after my inauguration in 1933 that I promised Dr. Bester that during the next 4 years I would come to Chautauqua again, and here I am. A few days ago, some of my friends in the press asked me the subject of this talk tonight. And I replied that for two good reasons I wanted to discuss the subject of peace. First, because it is eminently appropriate in Chautauqua. And secondly, because in the hurly-burly of domestic politics, it is important that our people should not overlook problems and issues which, though they lie beyond our borders, may and probably will have a vital influence on the United States of the future. Many people who have visited me in Washington in the past few months may have been surprised when I have told them that personally, and because of my own daily contacts with all manner of difficult problems, I am more concerned and less cheerful about international world conditions than about our immediate domestic prospects. And I say this to you not as a confirmed pessimist, but as one who still hopes that envy, hatred, and malice among nations have reached their peak and will be succeeded by a new tide of peace and goodwill. I say this as one who has participated in many of the decisions of peace and war during and after the World War, as one who has traveled much, as one who has spent a goodly portion of every 24 hours in the study of foreign relations. Long before I returned to Washington as President of the United States, I had made up my mind that pending what might be called a more opportune time on other continents, the United States could best serve the cause of a peaceful humanity by setting an example. And that is why, on the 4th of March, 1933, I made the following declaration. In the field of world policy, I would dedicate this nation to the policy of the good neighbor, the neighbor who resolutely respects himself, and because he does so, respects the rights of others, the neighbor who respects his obligations and respects the sanctity of agreement in and with a world of neighbors. That declaration represented my purpose then. It represents my purpose now. But it represents more than a purpose now, for it stands for a practice. To a measurable degree, the practice has succeeded. And the whole world now knows that the United States cherishes no predatory ambition. We are strong, but less powerful nations know that they need not fear our strength. We seek no conquest, we stand for peace. In the whole world of the Western Hemisphere, our good neighbor policy has produced results that are especially heartening. The noblest monument to peace The noblest monument to economic and social friendship in all the world is not a monument in bronze or stone. It is the boundary that unites the United States and Canada, 3,000 miles of friendship with no barbed wires, no guns, no soldiers, and no passport on the whole frontier. What made it? Mutual trust. And to extend the same sort of mutual trust throughout the Americas was our aim. The American republics to the south of us have been ready always to cooperate with the United States on a basis of equality and mutual respect. But before we inaugurated the good neighbor policy, there was among them resentment and fear because certain administrations in Washington had slighted their national pride and their sovereign rights. In pursuance of the good neighbor policy, and because in my younger days, I had learned many lessons in the hard school of experience, I stated that the United States was opposed definitely to armed intervention. And so, in these 4 years, we have negotiated a Pan-American Convention embodying the principle of non-intervention. We have abandoned the Platt Amendment that gave us the right to intervene in the internal affairs of the Republic of Cuba. We have withdrawn American Marines from Haiti. We have signed a new treaty which places our relations with Panama on a mutually satisfactory basis. We have undertaken a series of trade agreements with other American countries to our mutual commercial profit. And finally, at the request of two neighboring republics, I hope to give assistance in the final settlement of the last serious boundary dispute between any of the American nations. Yes, throughout the Americas, the spirit of the good neighbor is a practical and living fact. The 21 American republics are not only living together in friendship and in peace, they are united in the determination so to remain. And to give substance to this determination, a conference will meet on December 1st of this year at the capital of our great southern neighbor, Argentina. And it is, I know, the hope of all chiefs of state of the Americas that this will result in measures that will banish wars forever from this vast portion of the earth. I've always thought that peace, like charity, begins at home. And that's why we have begun at home, here in North and South and Central America. But peace in the Western world is not all we seek. It is our hope that knowledge of the practical application of the good neighbor policy in this hemisphere will be borne home to our neighbors across the seas. For ourselves, we are on good terms with them. Terms in most cases of straightforward friendship and peaceful understanding. But of necessity, we are deeply concerned about tendencies of recent years among many of the nations of other continents. It is a bitter experience to us when the spirit of agreements to which we are a party is not lived up to. It is an even more bitter experience for the whole company of nations to witness not only the spirit but the letter of international agreements violated with impunity and without regard to the simple principles of honor. Permanent friendships among nations as between men can be sustained only by scrupulous respect for the pledged word. And in spite of all this, we have sought steadfastly to assist international movements to prevent war. We cooperated to the bitter end, and it was a bitter end, in the work of the General Disarmament Conference. When it failed, we sought a separate treaty to deal with the manufacture of arms and the international traffic in arms. That proposal also came to naught. We participated, again to the bitter end, in a conference to continue naval limitations. And when it became evident that no general treaty could be signed because of the objections of certain other nations, we concluded with Great Britain and France a conditional treaty of qualitative limitations, which, much to my regret, already shows signs of ineffectiveness. We shun political commitments which might entangle us in foreign wars. We avoid connection with the political activities of the League of Nations, but I am glad to say that we have cooperated wholeheartedly in the social and humanitarian work at Geneva. Thus, we are a part of the world effort to control traffic in narcotics, to improve international health, to help child welfare, to eliminate double taxation, and to better working conditions and laboring hours throughout the world. No, we are not isolationists, except insofar as we seek to isolate ourselves from war. Yet we must remember that so long as war exists on Earth, there will be some danger, even to the nation that most ardently desires peace, danger that it also may be drawn into war. I have seen war. I have seen war on land and sea. I have seen blood running from the wounded. I have seen men coughing out their gassed lungs. I have seen the dead in the mud. I have seen cities destroyed. I have seen 200 limping, exhausted men come out of line. The survivors of a regiment of 1,000 that went forward 48 hours before. I have seen children starving. I have seen the agony of mothers and wives. I hate war. Unnumbered hours, and I shall pass unnumbered hours, thinking and planning how war may be kept from the United States of America. I wish I could keep war from all nations, but that is beyond my power. I can at least make certain that no act of the United States helps to produce or to promote war. I can at least make clear that the conscience of America revolts against war, and that any nation that provokes war forfeits the sympathy of the people of the United States. there are many causes that produce war. There are ancient hatreds, turbulent frontiers, the legacy of old, forgotten, far-off things and battles long ago. There are newborn fanaticisms, convictions on the part of certain peoples that they have become the unique depositories of ultimate truth and right. A dark old world was devastated by wars between conflicting religions. A dark modern world faces wars between conflicting economic and political fanaticism in which are intertwined race hatred. To bring it home to us, it is as if within the territorial limits of the United States, 48 nations, 48 forms of government, 48 customs barriers, 48 languages, 48 eternal and different verities were spending their time and their substance in a frenzy of effort to make themselves strong enough to conquer their neighbors or strong enough to defend themselves against their neighbors. In one field of that of economic barriers, the American policy may be, I hope, of some assistance in discouraging the economic source of war, and therefore a contribution toward the peace of the world. The trade agreements which we are making are not only finding outlets for the products of American fields and American factories, but they are also pointing the way to the elimination of embargoes, quotas, and other devices that place such pressure on nations not possessing great natural resources, that to those nations, the price of peace sometimes seems less terrible than the price of war. We do not maintain that a more liberal international trade will stop war, but we do fear that without a more liberal international trade, war is a natural sequence. The Congress of the United States, as you know, has given me certain authority to provide safeguards of American neutrality in case of war. The President of the United States, who under our Constitution is vested with primary authority to conduct our international relations, thus has been given new weapons with which to maintain American neutrality. Nevertheless, and I speak from long experience, the effective maintenance of American neutrality depends today, as in the past, on the wisdom and the determination of whoever at the moment occupy the offices of President and Secretary of State. It is clear that our present policy and the measures passed by the Congress would, in the event of a war on some other continent, reduce war profits, which would otherwise accrue to American citizens. Industrial and agricultural production for a war market may give immense fortunes to a few, but for the nation as a whole, we know that it produces disaster. It was the prospect of war profits that made our farmers in the West plow up prairie land that ought never to have been plowed, but should have been left for grazing cattle. And today we're reaping the harvest of those war profits in the dust storms that have devastated those war plowed fields. It was the prospect of war profits that caused the extension of monopoly and unjustified expansion of industry and a price level so high that the normal relationships between debtor and creditor was destroyed. Nevertheless, if war should break out again in another continent, let us not blink the fact that we would find in this country thousands of Americans who, seeking immediate riches, fool's gold would attempt to break down or evade our neutrality. They would tell you, and unfortunately, their views would get wide publicity by methods that you can understand as readily as I do, that if they could produce and ship this and that and the other article to belligerent nations, the unemployed of America would all find work. They would tell you that if they could extend credit to warring nations, that credit would be used in the United States to build homes and factories and pay our debts. They would tell you that America once more would capture the trade of the world. My friends, it would be hard to resist that clamor. It would be hard for many Americans, I fear, to look beyond, to realize the inevitable penalties, the inevitable day of reckoning that comes from a false prosperity. To resist the clamor of that greed, if war should come, would require the unswerving support of all Americans who love peace. And so, if we face the choice of profits or peace, this nation will answer. This nation must answer. We choose peace. And it is the duty of all of us, each and every one of us, men, women, and children, to encourage such a body of public opinion throughout this nation that the answer will be clear and for all practical purposes, unanimous. With that wise and experienced man who is our Secretary of State, whose statesmanship has met with such wide approval, I have thought and worked long and hard on the problem of keeping the United States at peace. But all the wisdom of America is not to be found in the White House or the Department of State. We need the meditation. We need the prayer. And we need the positive support of the people of America who go along with us in seeking peace. No matter how well we are supported by neutrality laws, we must remember that no laws can be provided to cover every contingency, for it is impossible to imagine how every future event may shape itself. In spite of every possible forethought, international relations involve of necessity a vast, uncharted area. In that area, safe sailing will depend on the knowledge and the experience and the wisdom of those who direct our foreign policy. Peace will depend on their day-to-day decisions. And at this late date, many years after, with the wisdom which is so easy after the event and so difficult before the event, we find it possible to trace the tragic series of small decisions that led Europe into the Great War in 1914 and eventually engulfed us and many other nations. We can keep out of war if those who watch and decide have a sufficiently detailed understanding of international affairs to make certain that the small decisions of each day do not lead toward war. And if at the same time they possess the courage to say no to those who selfishly or unwisely would get us into war. Of all the nations in the world today, we are in many ways most singularly blessed. Our closest neighbors are good neighbors. And if there are remoter nations that wish us not good but ill, they know that we are strong. They know that we can and will defend ourselves and defend our neighborhood. They know that we seek to dominate no other nation, that we ask no territorial expansion, that we oppose imperialism, and that we desire reduction in world armament. We believe in democracy. We believe in freedom, and we believe in peace. And so we offer to every nation of the world the hand clasp of the good neighbor. Let those who wish our friendship look us in the eye and take our hand.